Will you join me for a time of prayer? Loving God, gracious God, God of all people, please bless the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts, that they may be acceptable to you. Amen. So, we've all are familiar with the story, with the parable of the Good Samaritan. Yes, we've heard of this. We're pretty familiar, even if we haven't read it. Now we have, but we know the story. And we know the lesson in the story is love your neighbor as yourself, right? We all get this. Yes, is there anyone who doesn't understand this? Okay, good. My work is done. I will see you all after lunch. Okay, but I have a question. If this is so straightforward, I have a question about it. Why does the lawyer ask Jesus two questions that he already knows the answer to? You ever wonder about that? He's a lawyer. The passage that they are talking about is from the book of Leviticus, the book of law. He's a lawyer. He would have known this book backwards and forwards, inside and out. When he asks Jesus those questions, he already knows the answer. There is no way he couldn't possibly already know the answer. So then why does he come with these two questions? Hold on to that thought. So some years ago, I was invited to help a friend move, and I got there a little early, and I ended up parking right in front of an empty baseball field for kids. And as I'm sitting there, I see there's this huge batting cage, empty. Nobody's there. You know, a batting cage, it's like probably 20, 30 feet long, and it's covered in netting. Like it's really high, like 12-foot high fencing, covered in soft netting that drapes all the way to the ground so that when you hit a ball, it can't fly out and hit anybody. And I see that there's something like moving around in there. So I take a closer look. I'm like peering through my car window, and I see that a bird has gotten trapped in the batting cage, this big old black bird. And you can see that it's flying desperately trying to get out. And it sort of flies up and crashes into the ceiling on one end, and then it hovers there for a second and then flies back to the other end and then crashes into the corner, hangs on for a second, and then flies back. And I don't know how long this has been going on, but it must have been for quite some time because you could see that its little tail feathers were all tattered. You know, it was missing little bits of feathers from its head. And every time it paused for just a split second, it was panting. Its mouth was wide open. And I just watched this thing, and I just knew it was going to die. It was going to either injure itself or just simply drop from sheer exhaustion and dehydration. But it didn't know how to do anything else but just go up. So have you guys ever heard of John Newton? You probably have, though you may not realize it. He's the man that wrote Amazing Grace. Have you heard of him? And the story, you know, he was on this ship, he was in the slave trade, he was in a big storm, he had this profound moment, and it was grace, and then after that he decided he didn't want to be part of the slave trade anymore, and then he wrote the song, right? Have we heard this, some version of it? Yeah, it's complete garbage, it didn't happen. Not like that anyway. The story of John Newton starts way, way prior when he was a child, when he learned about what love meant. See, when he was a child, his father was a sailor, and his father would go off for long periods, months and months at a time, and so he was primarily raised by his mother, and she was a good mom. She did a good job, except that when he was 7 years old, she died. She just died. And so John learned that to be truly loved meant to be abandoned by those who you depend upon the most. So John's father, after some time, found another woman, and he remarried. And they were good parents until they had a baby together. And at that point, John's world, he was suddenly invisible because the new baby took up so much of the time and so much of the attention of his parents that he just simply ceased to exist. And he says when he remembered that time period, he said, I was convinced that my father loved me, but he was determined not to show it. I was convinced that my father loved me, but he was determined not to show it. So John was learning that to be loved meant you could be invisible. You could cease to matter. And so as he got older, because of all this stuff going on, you know, he'd had a lot going on in his life, he started to get into trouble. He started to run with a bad crowd. He started to get, you know, called into question by local authorities. And he started to get into so much trouble that his parents decided to send him off to this, like, military academy for troubled youths that they had back in England in the 1700s. And the headmaster there loved those boys. He loved them. He wanted them to grow up to be productive, healthy, happy citizens that could function well in their community. And he used some pretty extreme methods to bring this out of them. Methods that nowadays would be considered illegal, probably be considered corporal punishment, that was really over the top and verbally abused them. And so John learned that to be truly loved meant to be physically and verbally abused. So as John got older, he ended up becoming a sailor just like his father. And he was on ships, and he had a lot of trouble. He had a lot of trouble with authority. You know, one of the things he used to do was he used to get into arguments and fights with his fellow sailors and with his captains. And he was known for having a foul mouth. Now get this, on a sailor ship, okay, surrounded by sailors with sailors' mouths, he was disciplined multiple times for his filthy mouth and filthy language. His captain would write in his disciplinary log, when John gets going, picking a fight with someone, he will curse and use every single filthy word in the entire English language. And when he runs out of words, he starts making up new ones and keeps going without even taking a breath. Okay? And so at a certain point, he had a falling out with his father, and he stopped writing to his father. He just cut him off. Cut him right off. And at a certain point, he got sick and tired of his crewmates. And so when they stopped, you know, briefly at land, he just left the ship and walked off and abandoned them and never came back. He just disappeared. And he used to put himself into really dangerous situations. He used to just try all sorts of crazy stunts. And that moment on the ship that we all hear about was not his first near-death experience. He actually had experienced almost 20 of them before he ever even got to that point, because he was so reckless with his own life. And it's really easy for us, it's really easy for me to look at all of the things that he did as an adult and say to myself, that John, he was not loving his neighbor as himself. But I would actually challenge that. I think that John was loving his neighbor exactly the way that he loved himself. So I'm sitting in my car watching this poor little bird, you know, go back and forth and back and forth. And I get it into my head, I'm going to rescue it. So I climb over this 12-foot fence and I get a little closer. I would like to say it was that easy. I just climbed over that fence. It took me a while and it was not graceful. But grace came later. And so I get there and I notice that at one end, there's a hole in the netting. It's pretty big. You know, it's like, you know, this big. And it's pretty clear that that's probably how the bird got in. But when it was frightened, when it was hungry, when it was tired, it didn't know how to go down. All of its instincts kicked in, and all it knew how to do was go up. All it knew how to do was fly up. And so it completely lost sight of a completely different choice that it had, that it could not see. And so I tried all sorts of things to get this bird out of the cage. I tried running around like this, going, shoo, 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 shoo. Very exciting to watch. Completely ineffective. I tried going up to the edge, you know where the hole was, and lifting it up and calmly explaining to the bird, do you see the hole? Just fly right out. Do you see the hole? You can see it, right? Very articulate. Completely ineffective. Then I remembered that I had a dozen donuts that I had purchased for the moving party in my trunk. So I climb back over the fence, get a donut, put it in my pocket, go back over the fence, go inside, and I spent quite some time flinging bits of sugar donuts all over, trying to create the little trail, right, so that it would follow it out. My pocket and my fingers got very sticky, completely ineffective. And that's when I remember that there are people who do this professionally, right? So I make the call. This person from animal control comes out, and she has a tool. She has a net on the end of a stick that's like 8 feet tall. And I'm like, this is awesome. This is what I've been needing. I grab that thing. She says, yeah, sure, you can help. I grab the pole and I start running after the bird. I'm going to catch this thing, right? I'm running. I'm chasing this thing. And this woman just looks at me and she goes, okay, stop. She says, that's never going to work. You cannot catch a bird in midair with a net. It is not possible. The only thing you can do is try to wear it out, she says, because anytime you come towards it, when they're in this state, when they are trapped and frightened and depleted in their resources, any attempt to help will be perceived as a threat. Any attempt to liberate will be perceived as an attempt to trap. They will always run from you. The only thing you can do is to tire them out more quickly by not allowing them to land until they are so exhausted that they literally fall from the sky, hit rock bottom, and can move no further. Then you can pick them up and take them out safely. Now, I don't know about you, but that was the saddest thing I'd ever heard. And that's what we did. So she stood on one end of the net with her little net on a pole, and I stood on the other end. And every time the bird came towards, you know, the ceiling to try and land for a second, I would kind of wave my net, and then it would have to fly back midair and then back and forth. And we got a little closer to each other. We sort of took steps till we were pretty close to each other to try and tire it out more quickly. And I knew what I was doing was the most effective thing, but it was also extremely sad. Okay? So we've had some recent events in Ferguson. Yes, we're all familiar with these. And they concern me. It concerns me greatly because these events didn't suddenly start in Ferguson. This isn't a brand new issue. This isn't a brand new thing. There's a history in this country that happened long before we got to the events in Ferguson. And it concerns me greatly when I see police officers dressed in military garb, military armor, military-grade weapons, praying before they go out. And you wonder how they see themselves. Are they praying as police officers to protect and serve, or are they praying as soldiers that they might win the war? And so I'd like to share with you a few quotes here. John Stossel from Fox Business News. Not someone I usually would quote. He says, if authorities arm cops like soldiers, they may begin to think like soldiers and see the public as the enemy. That makes violent confrontations more likely. And a ministerial colleague of mine wrote, I don't watch John Stossel, but I can tell you that this quote is truth. As someone who used to do acting, I can tell you the power of putting on the costume. As someone who puts on an academic robe and a clerical stole on Sunday mornings, I can tell you the power of putting on the costume. As someone who purposefully wears a clergy collar in certain circumstances, I can tell you the power of putting on the costume. When we dress our police like soldiers and arm them like soldiers, they will start acting like soldiers. And in a time of threat, that means shoot to kill first and then think about alternatives. A soldier's job is to win the battle. A cop's job is to serve and protect. Different costumes, different jobs. And so, when we think about loving our neighbors as ourselves and we see how these events have been unfolding back and forth and back and forth, I found another quote that I would like to share with you that talked about what it was like on slave ships and what it was like on the Ivory Coast back in the 1700s. And he talks about what it was like to have fewer crew members trying to guard a whole bunch of people that didn't want to be there, that had been oppressed and their liberties had been stripped from them. And he says, it was so bad so that sometimes not 10 men can be mustered because the crew members would become sick and they didn't want to participate in this either. So not 10 men can be mustered to watch night and day over 200, besides having all the other business of the ship to attend. That these precautions are so often effectual is much more to be wondered at than that they sometimes fail. One unguarded hour or minute is sufficient to give the slaves the opportunity they are always waiting for. An attempt to rise upon the ship's company, brings on instantaneous and horrid war. For when they are once in motion, they are desperate, and where they do not conquer, they are seldom quelled without much mischief and bloodshed on both sides. If they can be found out, they must be treated as villains and punished to intimidate the rest. These punishments, in their nature and degree, depend upon the sovereign will of the captain. Some are content with inflicting such moderate punishments as may suffice for example, but unlimited power, instigated by revenge, and where the heart, by a long familiarity with the sufferings of them, is become callous and insensible to the pleadings of humanity, is terrible. Surely it must be allowed that they who are long conversant with the such scenes as these are liable to imbibe a spirit of ferociousness and savage insensibility of which human nature, depraved as it is not ordinarily capable. Retaliation on their parts furnishes a plea for reprisal on ours. Thus, in one place or another, trade is often suspended, all intercourse cut off, and things are in a state of war, till necessity, either on the ship's part or on theirs, produces overtures of peace and dictates the price which the offending party must pay for it. But it is a warlike peace. We trade under arms, and they are furnished with long knives. For with few exceptions, the English and the Africans reciprocally consider each other as the consummate villains, who are always watching opportunities to do mischief. In short, we have, I fear, too deservedly, a very unfavorable character upon the coast. When I have charged a black with unfairness and dishonesty, he has answered, if able to clear himself, with an air of disdain, "Who do you think I am? A white man?" This was written by John Newton in 1788 and published, and it became a huge catalyst in the abolitionist movement. In fact, it sold out so quickly they had to make several more printings. But we're not to that part of the story yet. See, John did find himself on a ship at one point, and there was a huge storm. It was the worst storm they'd ever been in. It got to the point that they gave up trying to steer, and they simply took ropes and tied themselves to the ship in the hope that at some point, if the storm abated, they might still be sort of attached to floating lumber, and they wouldn't die. But they really didn't expect to survive the night. And so John was tied up with one of his crewmates to this big post on the ship. And at that point, John didn't believe in God. He just didn't. He didn't think God had existed. He did not have any room for that in his life. But for some reason, and when he was asked later, he could not explain why in that moment he called out and he said, "God, have mercy on us. God, have mercy on us." And he didn't understand why he said it at the time. It made no sense because he didn't believe in God, and he certainly didn't believe that God owed him any mercy after all the things that he had done in his life. But the storm did start to slow down some hours later, and the storm eventually ebbed, and the ship was saved, and the crew was saved. And it was an interesting moment for John, but it was not a bombshell moment. It took many, many years of thinking and questioning that for him to get to where he got. And he ended up making some small questions. You know, that's weird. I didn't really believe in God, but then, you know, I felt like this was sort of an answer to a prayer. And I didn't think that I was really worthy of God's mercy, and yet God appeared to have been merciful. Why? Why would he do that for me if I didn't warrant it? And so he started to change his perception of God's love, and he started to think maybe he doesn't have to earn it. Maybe it's unconditional. Maybe God gives it anyway, just because. And so he started making small changes in his life. He stopped being so reckless. He thought, well, you know, maybe my life is worth a little more, and I don't have to keep putting it at risk all the time. So he started changing his behavior. And he got back some years later. This took years and years. He got back in touch with his dad and started corresponding again. And so that went better. And he stopped fighting with his crewmates all the time. But in order to do that, he had to give up drinking, because those things were kind of tied hand in hand. So he gave up drinking, and he started getting along with people better. And then there was a woman in his life that he had known from childhood named Mary. And he wanted to marry her. And so he approached her parents and talked about that. And they said, "Oh, heck no, we know about you. We know all about you. forget it. But they allowed him to correspond with her. So he had to clean up his language enough to be able to write letters to a lady. I think that would have been one of his more difficult tasks. But he did. He cleaned up his language, and he was able to correspond with her. I'm sure that her parents were reading every single letter before it came in, you know, that they were censoring any letter that came in. So he had to be really careful. But after some years of correspondence, eventually they relented, and he was able to marry her. And after he got married, he discovered that he did not like so much abandoning her for months at a time, being a sailor. So he stopped being a sailor, and he started looking at ministry. He started looking into theology. He kept asking these questions about God's grace and God's mercy and God's unconditional love and what it looks like to be a child of God, created perfectly in God's image, completely deserving of love. And he ended up becoming a minister, and after some years, he wrote the book that I just read from. And him with a bunch of other people combined with ministers and people in the country, they were able to abolish the slave trade in England. And it makes me think, when we talk about loving our neighbor as ourselves, at this point, John is still loving his neighbor as himself. But at this point, he's loving his neighbor because he loves God first, with all of his heart and all of his mind and all of his spirit and all of his strength. He's in a relationship now, and he knows that God loves him too with all of his heart and mind and spirit and strength. And so when he loves his neighbor as himself, he loves him more fully, with more compassion and with more gentleness. So we come back to our original two questions. Our original question, why would the lawyer ask Jesus two questions he already knows the answer to? Testing is part of it. I think that the lawyer asked those two questions for the exact same reason that the robbers beat up the man in the road in the first place, for the same reason that the priest walked on by, for the same reason that the Levite ignored him, and for the same reason that the Good Samaritan stopped. I think they were all loving their neighbors as themselves. Because the Levite, the lawyer, he had learned about God through the book of Leviticus. And if you've ever read the book of Leviticus, you know that it's all about keeping your I's dotted and your T's crossed. That relationship with God is all about being on your guard all the time and doing everything right. And there's a lot of conflict in there. You could be doing something right in chapter 1, but at the same time be violating something else in chapter 14. And that's exactly how the lawyer loved Christ. By trying to trip him up, by trying to make sure he had all of his I's dotted and all of his T's crossed. And so something with the Good Samaritan, we don't know what happened. The story doesn't give us the details. But somehow he had a better understanding of God's love for him, so that when he loved his neighbor as himself, he loved him with compassion, with an understanding that this person had every right to food, health, nurture, gentleness, and unconditional love without judgment. And he loved his neighbor more fully. So I'm standing in this cage, right? And we're about 5 feet apart. And the bird's going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And it's just so sad to watch. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, the bird dives down. And that fast, it's out of the net and flying free across the fields towards the trees on the other side. And neither of us could believe it. Neither of us could believe that that bird, which had been going like this for the past days, suddenly would go against its instincts. Go down instead of go up. Go straight towards what it feared instead of try to go away from it. And I looked down. I couldn't figure out how it got out of the net. And I looked down, and all the way at the ground, right where it had disappeared, there was a little hole, no bigger than this, in the net. Somehow it had suddenly seen what it had not been able to see before. In that moment, everything changed. And Caroline, the woman who was helping with this, started laughing, and she says, "You know what? I bet that that bird is in its nest someplace right now, flat on its back, going like this. Thank God. Thank God. Thank God for that moment where we can change the patterns that have plagued us for our whole lives." And I looked at her, And I said, you know what? I'll bet you're right. Can I get an amen to that? Amen.